well argued and well briefed by both parties. We will issue our decision within the 90-day statutory timeframe. The next case on our calendar today is A18-0083, the matter, the State of Minnesota versus Jose Barrios German. Good morning, Council. Give you a minute to get settled. I think you know each side will have 15 minutes for their argument, and then the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you could please state your name for the record and the party you represent, you can go ahead and be seated. And you can adjust the podium as necessary. So counsel for appellant can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sharon Jacks, and I'm the Assistant State Public Defender representing Jose Barrios German. Mr. German is challenging his conviction for first-degree possession of methamphetamine. That conviction can't stand because there's insufficient evidence to sustain it. There's an alternative theory of his evidence and that of his innocence, and that is that the passenger in the truck that day is the person who placed the drugs inside the duffel bag behind her in the truck. The evidence shows that she had the opportunity and the ability to place those drugs in the duffel bag. That night,
And just to be clear, there's no allegation that the drugs that were found in Mr. Armand's wallet was placed there by her, correct?
No,
this
absolutely
is just focused
not.
On the duffel
yeah.
bag.
Yeah, and the drugs in his wallet was, I think, residue on a dollar bill, indicating he had used methamphetamine or someone had used methamphetamine and that dollar was in his wallet. That certainly is a circumstance that is consistent with his guilt because it would indicate he's a drug user. But the evidence also indicates that she is a drug user. And in fact, the officer indicated that she had a criminal history of both using drugs and was involved in drug and arms possessions.
Well, and the state, I think, disputes whether or not those two circumstances you referred to are actually circumstances proved.
Absolutely. And really that's the main point of dispute in this case is whether this court can consider those circumstances and determining whether or not there is a alternative theory of innocence. I'd point the court to State versus Al Nasir. That's cited in our brief. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court brief. And in footnote 2 of that case, the court was really clear that in determining the circumstances proved, the appellate court considers evidence that's inconsistent with guilt as long as it's not in conflict with other evidence. And then,
I mean, you're raising a point that obviously has been raised on numerous occasions with people critical of the Al Nasir test, in that what are the circumstances proved? And I think we have to look at the jury's acceptance of the proof of the circumstances. We defer to that, and its rejection of evidence in the record that conflicts with evidence proved by the state, right?
Correct, if there's anything conflicting.
That's under Silver now. Now, well, was this argument made to the jury that she, you know, had time to plant this in his duffel bag with his identification?
Absolutely, that was the defense. That's the entire, you know, closing argument of the defense. It is.
But wouldn't that then be evidence that was rejected by the jury?
No.
I mean, if that was the sole defense and the jury obviously heard it and they reject it, how can you resurrect it under the Silver Nail test?
It's not that the jury rejected it. It rejected a theory of innocence, which this court doesn't defer to. So the Al Nasir is clear, and Harris, and all of the Minnesota Supreme Court case law, that this court gives no deference to what inferences the jury makes from the circumstances proved.
And you're talking about the second step of the circumstantial evidence.
Absolutely.
Analysis.
So with respect to your question, Judge Hooten, with regards to don't we assume that the jury rejected that evidence? Absolutely not. Again, I point you to El Nasir or more recently the Supreme Court's decision just last year in State versus Harris. State versus El Nasir. It's a criminal vehicular homicide case, and there the state was required to prove that Mr. El Nasir knew or should have known that he had been in an accident. The court finds an alternative theory of innocence based on two facts that are inconsistent with his guilt. The state's witness, a police officer, testifies that the evidence showed that he could have been asleep or unconscious at the time, so he wouldn't have known. The Minnesota Supreme Court also relied on the fact that a police officer, a state witness, testified that Mr. El Nasir would not have been able to see the scene of the crime as he was driving away because the glare of the victim's headlights would have obscured his vision in his rearview mirror. Those are both facts that are inconsistent with Mr. El Nasir's guilt, but the Minnesota Supreme Court relies on them to find a theory of innocence because it's evidence that's offered by the state, and it's uncontroverted. The same thing happens in State versus Harris just last year. It's a possession of a firearm case. And in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court reverses based on a theory of innocence. And the facts the Minnesota Supreme Court relies on are facts that were inconsistent with Mr. Harris's guilt. The court relied on the fact that it wasn't his car. The court relied on the where the gun was found. The court relied on the fact that there were other individuals in the car, and it could have been one of the passengers. That's inconsistent with his guilt. The court relied on...
So if I had to summarize then, so you're saying that because this was a... you're saying this was a reasonable inference that was
correct.
Argued to the jury, and that we do not defer to the reasonable inferences that could or could not have been...
Absolutely.
By the jury.
Absolutely. Right.
But as I understand it, the passenger did not testify, correct?
She did not.
All right. So if she would have testified and there was a rejection and she would have said, I did it, I put it in there, and the jury rejected it, then you'd be in a different position.
We would, right? And that's the case that the state relies on, State mm-hmm. versus Hawes. That's a murder case where the defendant testifies contrary to all the state's evidence, hey, that wasn't me, I didn't aid and abet in this murder. And the Minnesota Supreme Court says that is in conflict with all of the state's evidence. Therefore, that's not a circumstance proof. We assume the jury rejected that. And so I think it's, you know, the question here really is what are the circumstances proved? And the Minnesota Supreme Court case law supports our position that it does include the police officer's testimony that she was a drug user and she had a criminal history involving drugs and weapons. So you look to that as well as the fact that she had the motive, the opportunity, and the ability to place the drugs in the duffel that night.
But let's look at the critical fact, which I think is the amount of time that she was in the car or the vehicle unattended. In your brief, you make reference to the video, but that video wasn't actually admitted into evidence. Is that correct?
That's correct. In our reply brief, we clarify that that cannot be considered a circumstance proved.
So the amount of time that was proved or the circumstance proved, it's 30 seconds to a minute.
What the officer testified to was roughly 30 seconds to a minute. He was not sure. He would need to review the video in order to determine how long it was. So in the minds of the jury, what they have is that the officer believes it was 30 seconds to a minute, but the officer isn't sure.
But didn't he also testify earlier, though, that they asked him if he had done some refreshers, is what the word they used, before he came to court that day, and he said, yes, I had a fair amount of knowledge on the case. I had to read my reports and watch body cam footage to remember the finite details.
Absolutely, he did, and he had to because this event had occurred over 3 years earlier. But then when they asked him about how long was Mr. Germán and outside of the car with the police officer in the dark, when the police officer indicated he could not see what was going on, the officer said, I think it was 30 seconds, roughly to a minute. I don't know. I would have to look at the police or at the video in order to refresh my recollection, and that was never done on redirect. So I would say even if it was 30 seconds to a minute, the only thing that Ms. Scraba needed to have done was to open her purse, pull out a bag, turn around, and place it in a duffel bag. I think she could have easily done that in 30 seconds, let alone a minute.
Was the duffel bag within arm's reach?
It was, and there was testimony to that effect.
Okay.
That anyone in the front seat could have reached the back seat and placed it there.
Okay.
Wasn't the methamphetamine found inside a glove?
It was.
It's not just reaching into the duffel bag and putting it in the duffel bag. It's getting the glove out, putting it in the glove, putting it back. I mean, that's much more complicated than just sticking something in a duffel bag and zipping the zipper.
I would say it might take a few more seconds, but I wouldn't say it was significantly more complicated to remove a glove, stick it in, and insert it. It's certainly something that you could do in 30 seconds, a minute, or as is the case in this case, it was actually 2 minutes. So, but even if this court doesn't believe that the evidence is insufficient, it's exactly that evidence or that misstatement of the record during closing argument that would entitle Mr. Herman to a new trial.
Why is that a misstatement of the record, though?
It's a misstatement of the record because what the officer testified to was that it was roughly 30 seconds to a minute, but he was not sure and he would need to review his video.
But he also said before that, he said that he did, in preparation for his testimony, that he reviewed the record, including the video.
But despite that review, with respect to the time the officer had Mr. Herman outside of the car, the officer was clear that despite that review, he couldn't remember. He would have to do a double check. And that's not what the prosecutor said. What the prosecutor said is that Officer Lutz testified, I reviewed my reports in my body cam. I watched what I did that night. Lutz refreshed his recollection and was able to testify very specifically as to what he did and what he remembered. And that's the exact opposite of what Officer Lutz said with respect to this one piece of information. How long was he outside of the car?
How is that inaccurate, though? How is that a mischaracterization? Because the prosecutor said he was able to testify very specifically, and he did. He did say it was 30 seconds to a minute. So that's a very specific time. It's not like he's saying, well, I was out of the car for a short period of time or a brief period. It wasn't a vague. It was very specific in terms of the time.
It was very specific as to the time he thought it was, and it was very specific to the fact that he couldn't remember specifically, and then he would have to look at the video in order to know for sure. And as we know, because the video is part of the record, it was longer. So
But that's not evidence that was before the jury, though.
But for purposes of the misconduct argument, whether or not that's a misstatement of the record, it is. And even if
how is that a misstatement of the record if all that's in front of the jury is that testimony and not the video itself?
It's a misstatement of the record, even if you remove the video, because it mischaracterizes Officer Lutz's testimony. Officer Lutz did not say that he specifically remembered that it was 30 seconds, or he specifically remembered that it was 30 seconds to a minute. He said he thought it was roughly 30 seconds to a minute, and he would have to review the video in order to know. I mean, I can read you specifically what Officer Lutz said.
Right.
Officer
Lutz's
testimony is,
I'd have to watch the body cam footage to tell you for sure.
Oh, okay, you got that. I don't need to read it to you then. and it's really key because, as you see in the sufficiency of the evidence argument, we're all focused on how long were they outside of the truck. And then we have a closing argument that makes no reference to that whatsoever. The defense argument that focuses almost exclusively on that. There's some reference to, it wasn't his truck, you know, like maybe it was the truck owner's, but then focuses in specifically, I think it's on page 282 and 285, on no, it was her. She had the opportunity and the ability to do it, and she was a drug user. And then in rebuttal argument, at the very end, the last thing the jury hears is this very strong statement from the prosecutor, now concerned that this defense has raised reasonable doubt, misstating exactly what it was that Officer Lutz said with regard to that degree of opportunity that Ms. Scraba would have had to place the drugs there. And we know it impacted the jury because the jury, it gave them doubt. They came back and said, hey, can we watch the body, body cam?
We'd be guessing as to why the jury asked for that. So I think that's speculation that we can't get into.
I would say that we don't know for sure, but to say it's mere speculation is an overstatement when we have that being the only question before the jury in the minute before they left to go deliberate.
Yeah, but we don't try to get into juries' heads as to what they're trying to do.
That's true, but this court does look to jury questions when trying to determine whether or not an error impacted the verdict. That this court routinely does that. Even if you want to remove the jury question from the analysis, you still have to look to, okay, this is a case that came down to, was it Ms. Scraba or was it Mr. Herman? Did she really have the opportunity or not? You know, the officer says, yeah, maybe 30 seconds to a minute, and the prosecutor comes back very strongly saying he knew it was, you know, 30 seconds. It wasn't, he takes out the roughly, he takes out the I need to review my the video in order to make that determination. And obviously does this to persuade the jury that there is no reasonable doubt. And, you know, that's in Caulfield and Litzau are two Supreme Court cases, both of which say, hey, when the error is aimed at securing a verdict, then it impacts the verdict and the right to a fair trial has been denied. That's when plain error requires reversal. Now, Caulfield,
I think you're... time is up, so if you can just wrap that thought up quickly, and then you'll have 5 minutes.
We would ask
for
that
rebuttal.
You reverse his conviction outright or grant him a new trial. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Evan Frazier. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney representing the respondent in this case. I'll start with the sufficiency of the evidence argument. As Judge Hooten noted, the case law on the subject says that the jury is in the best position to decide and evaluate this evidence, and the court on appeal must defer to the jury's acceptance or rejectance of that evidence. The jury here clearly rejected the evidence that the passenger in the vehicle could have done what the defense argued it could, she did.
Well, is that really true, though, or did the jury just find beyond a reasonable doubt that he was the one who put it in? Because on our review, we give no deference whatsoever to what the jury found or what a district court found. We review that. That's an issue we review de novo on the second prong of the circumstantial evidence test.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would just say I believe that's true. And as far as the circumstances proved us to the first step of that test, I believe the respondent believes that the evidence that was proved, the circumstances were proved, should disregard the couple of facts that appellant puts in his argument about Ms. Scraba's history.
How is that inconsistent with the verdict, though? I mean, is the fact that she has a criminal history, that isn't necessarily inconsistent with convicting him of this crime?
Sure,
or
you're right.
She has used drugs.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would argue for a couple of reasons. First off, I think clearly upon review, it's 404 character evidence that should not have been allowed in the first place. And so I don't know that the appeals court here should be considering that and making a determination for a new trial and something that's clearly not allowed by the rules.
Well, but it was entered into evidence, correct?
It was,
and
Your Honor.
Wasn't at least part of it entered in by the police officers themselves?
On cross-examination, correct.
Okay, so was that uncontroverted?
It was uncontroverted, Your Honor. I would point you, though, to the Hawes case that appellant cited in her argument, and the quote from Hawes is, under this standard, we disregard testimony that is inconsistent with the verdict.
But there was no testimony here by the passenger.
Correct. There's testimony by Officer Lutz about the passenger's knowledge and her ability to do this. And
how is that testimony inconsistent with the verdict, though?
Your Honor, I think that testimony is, it's inconsistent with the verdict as to what the purpose of the testimony was, to put her, to put the passenger in the place to be able to put the methamphetamine in the bag and put her in position to commit this crime rather than the defendant who was on trial for it. And I think that's how it's inconsistent. It's not directly inconsistent, just looking at the fact in isolation, but the effect that the evidence was supposed to have on the jury is inconsistent.
But the argument that was made to the jury is that it's a reasonable inference when you leave another drug addict in a car that has drugs in their possession that they're going to that they might dump those drugs on the other in the other person's belongings, so that they're not charged with the crime.
Correct, Your Honor. That was one
and,
of the
and that was the that and the law is we cannot. As a, I mean, we cannot defer to the reasonable inferences that may or may not have been drawn by the jury.
Correct, Your Honor. I would agree.
And aren't we in reasonable inference territory here?
Your Honor, I don't believe we are for the specific fact that the circumstances prove that the methamphetamine was found within reach of Mr. Herman, that the methamphetamine was located in close proximity to his items.
Let me ask you a question. You just touched on something I hadn't thought about before. The duffel bag in the back was within arm's reach of both parties, correct?
Correct.
Do you consider that a circumstance proved or not?
Your Honor, I think yes, because that was testified by the officer, I believe on cross-examination, he testified that it was within arm's reach and that the middle seat had been folded down.
Okay, so that's uncontroverted evidence, correct?
Correct.
And that actually points in either direction, literally.
Correct.
So why is that? So that's a circumstance proved then?
Your Honor, I would agree.
Okay. So then why isn't the fact that she's also a meth user, which also came in via cross-examination of the officer and uncontroverted, why isn't that circumstance proved as well?
Your Honor, I guess for the reason I stated before that the effect of that evidence on the jury was intended to be that she was the one that committed this crime, and that is inconsistent with the verdict that the jury returned. And so that can't be a circumstance proved because it's clearly rejected by the jury, and is not. It can't be a circumstance proved then. We may argue on that.
Okay, but that seems inconsistent with them being able to reach the duffel bag, though, doesn't it?
I think it's inconsistent with her. I think it's inconsistent with her being able to reach the duffel bag. I think the testimony that appellant could reach the duffel bag from where he's sitting, that's consistent with the jury's verdict, that it was within arm's reach, and that helps the constructive possession argument that it's under his dominion and control at the time Officer Lutz approached the vehicle. I would also note the other evidence that strongly shows that the only reasonable inference is that Mr. Herman was in constructive possession of the methamphetamine was that, in fact, there was over a half a gram of methamphetamine found in the dollar bill in Mr. Herman's wallet. And through testimony of both Officer Lutz as well as the BCA agent and Sergeant Linscheid of the Drug Task Force, they all describe both of those substances as similar colored. And so you have methamphetamine that's a off-white, brownish, reddish color found both in the duffel bag as well as Mr. Herman's wallet. And in fact, in the Sam case that both parties cite in their briefs, the court concluded there was a reasonable inference to find the defendant was not guilty in that case because the passenger had methamphetamine in his wallet, where the large amount of methamphetamine was found in the glove box. And so the court used that, obviously, to help the appellant in that case. In this case, it's a circumstance proved, and it shows that there is no other reasonable inference.
What were the circumstances proved as to what the passenger had in her purse? I think there was some disagreement with regard to that in the briefing.
Yes, Your Honor. And looking back at the transcript, it does show that the search that Officer Lutz testified about was strictly for weapons. He did note that he did pat her down and found nothing, and I'm sure the court's aware of the plain field doctrine of where if he felt a controlled substance or he felt some or some paraphernalia, that would be something he would have been able to find, and so I believe it's a reasonable inference to go off of his testimony that when he says he found nothing on the pat search, so he didn't find anything, but then obviously he says the search of the bag was for weapons only, and there was no follow-up testimony about that search.
Can I ask you this? Because assuming that we agree on what the circumstances proved are, we get now to the next stage of the test, which is that the circumstances proved support a reasonable or rational inference that the passenger possessed the drugs and moved them from her purse into the duffel bag. Is that a rational inference? And if not, why not?
Your Honor, I don't think it is. One, for the argument I just gave about the Sam case, where the court looked at the fact that there was a smaller amount of methamphetamine that was clearly in the possession of the passenger. Here you have a small amount of methamphetamine that matches the color of the large amount of methamphetamine found in the duffel bag that was found in the wallet. The officer Lutz testified he saw Mr. Herman take out of his pocket, pull out his ID from. That's a clear connection to the item or the methamphetamine found in the duffel bag, along with...
But doesn't that go to the issue of whether or not there's a reasonable inference that he was guilty of possession?
Correct, Your Honor. But
that's a separate inquiry as to whether or not there's another alternative reasonable inference.
I don't know that that's necessarily true, Your Honor, just because... When you're looking at that fact, that would make any other rational inference or any other inference irrational. The fact that he's got this small amount of methamphetamine that matches that color that's found in the duffel bag, that would make the inference that the passenger was the one that moved the methamphetamine into the duffel bag, that would make it irrational based on his proximity to that methamphetamine, his possession of the same color, along with the fact that his items were found in the duffel bag pocket was zipped, his Mystic Lake player's card was found in the same pouch as the methamphetamine. And these are all facts that are laid out in other cases that I've cited in my brief where the court looks at those instances to show that there is no other rational inference. If there are no other questions on sufficiency evidence, I'll move on to the misconduct argument.
I just had one last question, and... Appellant didn't address this, and so she'll have an opportunity on rebuttal, but I did want to ask about the third circumstance proof that was argued in the brief about the lack of DNA from Mr. Herman or fingerprints on the bag of drugs. Is that a circumstance proved? And if not, why not?
Your Honor, I think it is a circumstance proved looking back now at the case law and having the opportunity to read the briefs. It's not inconsistent with the jury's verdict. It's not something that they necessarily rejected outhand in order to convict Mr. Herman of this offense, and so I would agree it probably is a circumstance proved.
Is there anything in the record saying one way or another, though? Is there something you could point to in the record that it says that the jury was told one way or the other whether there was DNA
and Your Honor,
testing done and what the results of that testing was?
Yes, Your Honor, and as standing here today, I can't recall whether or not that was part of testimony of either the BCA analyst or Sergeant Linscheid of the Drug Task Force or even Officer Lutz.
Well, if we don't see anything in the record, can we... take it as a circumstance proof?
I would argue if it's not in the record, then it can't be a circumstance proof because it was not placed before the jury as part of the evidence.
So then it would just be an argument by counsel as to what was missing that they should have produced.
Correct. As far as the prosecutorial misconduct argument, it's the appellant's burden, first off, to show that there was error and it was plain, and in the eyes of the respondent, the appellant has failed to show there was error. I think Judge Reyes kind of talked about how is this a mischaracterization, and I would point the court to Officer Lutz's testimony, and I know we spent a lot of time talking about his first answer to the question about on page 184 of the transcript, about 30 seconds to a minute roughly, I'd have to watch the body cam footage to tell you for sure. The follow-up question by defense counsel is, would it surprise you if it was over a minute? And he says yes. And then I believe defense counsel says okay. And Officer Lutz then says, we weren't out there out that long, I didn't think. So it's the respondent's argument that it's a reasonable inference to argue that, in fact, what Officer Lutz's testimony was is it was 30 seconds to a minute, but I couldn't tell you within that time range because I know it wasn't over a minute. I didn't think it was over a minute. So I can't tell you. I'd have to watch the body cam footage to be sure whether it was closer to 30 seconds or whether it was closer to a minute. And that's what the prosecutor argued on rebuttal argument. Is that he testified clearly. There's a 30-second window here. I'm not sure if it's closer to 30 seconds or a minute, but that's pretty specific. And he watched his body cam and he read his reports before he came in and testified to you. And he remembered everything he did. And in fact, on cross-examination by defense counsel, she states, you remember everything pretty well. And he said, yeah, I went and reviewed all this stuff before I came and testified today. So based on that, it's the respondent's argument that there is no error by the prosecutor, and so the court's analysis should end there. I think even if the court gets to the point where it's deciding whether or not there was an effect on the substantial rights of the appellant, the case law is clear that the court has to review the closing argument as a whole. And in this case, the rebuttal argument was 3 pages of transcript long. The primary argument combined with the rebuttal argument was about 10 pages long. As noted, appellant's counsel at trial argued both that the passenger did this as well as, well, maybe it was the driver or maybe it's the owner of the car who possessed the methamphetamine. So there were kind of two competing theories of the case that maybe that explains the effect on the jury of why they decided to convict Mr. Herman. So it's not clear that this error, if the court finds there was error, was the substantial cause of the verdict. And I would just note the cases cited by the appellant in her reply brief, none of those have to do with this kind of issue where there's one comment in a rebuttal argument that causes a reversal. Litzau was a Crawford statement issue. Mayhorn was many issues of prosecutorial misconduct. And so for those reasons, Your Honor, I see my time is up. I would just ask that you sustain the conviction on both issues.
Thank you.
I'd like to point the court to State versus Caulfield because that was a case in which there was only one statement made in closing argument referencing the erroneously admitted evidence. And the Minnesota Supreme Court held that that still impacted the verdict because it went to the heart of the case. Counsel's right, it's not a misconduct case. It's an inadmissible evidence case. But as to whether or not that error affected the verdict, the court noted that there had been one reference to it in closing argument.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Because it's kind of the flip side of what I asked the respondent. And that is with regard to the alternative reasonable inference from the circumstances proved. I mean, what facts can you point to that makes it a reasonable alternative versus just mere speculation? How do you suggest that we as a reviewing court analyze that issue?
The facts that I would point to is that she was a known drug user who also had a history of, a criminal history of drug possession, that she was in the car, had been stopped by an officer who knew her and her associates. That was Officer Lutz's testimony. So she knew that he knew that she was a drug user and possessor. So she had the motive to get rid of any drugs she had in her purse because she knew he was coming back and searching her purse, which he did.
Is that in the record?
That's in the record. I mean, it's not in the record what she knew. I'm inferring that from her circumstances, her relationship with Officer Lutz, and the fact that they had been stopped and he was searching the, you know, the driver of the truck, Mr. Herman. We also have that she had the ability to place the drugs there. It was right behind her, and the testimony was that she could reach it. And she had the opportunity He was outside of the truck for a period of time. It was dark out. Officer Lutz testified he was not paying any attention and he couldn't see inside the truck. So it's that motive, opportunity, and ability to do so that from which you can infer reasonably that it could have been her that did that. And that places a reasonable doubt on whether it was him. This case,
just going back to the circumstances proved for a minute, the question of the lack of DNA evidence, was there any testimony one way or another about DNA evidence, whether there was DNA testing?
There was not, nor with respect to fingerprints. The testimony was that the BCA had analyzed the drugs just for the drugs. There was nothing about asking the BCA to test on fingerprints or DNA, which, as you all know, is routinely done in cases relating to possession of drugs and possession of weapons. That's one of the things that the state almost always asks the BCA to do.
I'm sorry. There isn't a circumstance proved, though, as to whether there was fingerprint evidence or not, or DNA evidence or not.
The circumstance proved is that only that the state didn't request the testing. There is no circumstance proof that his DNA was not on it, absolutely.
So that's not a circumstance proof then?
No. Circumstance proof is not that his DNA was not on it. A circumstance proof or a fact in the case is that it was never requested.
But that's not in the record, though. How can...
The circumstance proved, or if you don't want to call it a circumstance proof, a fact in this case that can be considered is that no DNA or fingerprint evidence was presented.
How can we consider that, though, as a circumstance?
Because it wasn't presented. It wasn't presented.
Right, but that's just an argument of counsel, what they should have done. I don't see how that can be considered a circumstance proof.
And that's why I'm saying, alternatively, if it's not a circumstance proof, it is a fact that can be considered, right? I mean, as you say, it's part of the totality of the circumstances in this case that the state could have done that and didn't. I'd like to address State versus Sam real briefly here. That is also a case of a driver and a passenger. Counsel is correct that in that case, an alternative theory of innocence was that the passenger possessed the drugs in part because the passenger had drugs in his possession. This case is different because here, although Mr. Herman had drugs in his possession, it was unlike in Sam. The other individual involved was also known to be a drug user and a drug possessor. So it's not a fact that points or eliminates any theory of innocence. I see my time is up. So unless the court has any further questions, we'd ask that you reverse.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you very much for your arguments. They were well done. And I apologize for mispronouncing Mr. Carman's name at the beginning. The matter is, thank you.